in the limelight.
On top of the surge in COVID cases across the United States of America, coronavirus hospitalizations are also soaring in more than a dozen states, according to data compiled by the COVID Tracking Project. The latest record-shattering coronavirus figures came days after Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, warned in an internal report dated November 2nd that the United States is entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic, and urged the Trump administration to take much more aggressive action. Cases are rapidly rising in nearly 30% of all USA counties, the highest number of county hotspots we have seen with this pandemic, reads Birx's report, which was obtained by the Post. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "This is a Tsunami. Pay attention. Experts horrified as COVID-19 hits new record in the United States of America." Here's the details of this article. With much of the United States' attention understandably consumed by developments in the high-stakes presidential election, the nation on Wednesday, November 4th, reported a daily record of more than 104,000 new COVID-19 infections, the latest alarming indication that far from U.S. President Donald Trump's repeated insistence that the virus is fading away, the deadly pandemic is only getting worse as the winter months approach. A count that worries me? Over 100,000 COVID-19 cases yesterday, Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonzalez tweeted on Thursday morning, November 5th. Death up 21%. There has been silence on this from the White House and the Dems. This is a tsunami washing over Americans. Pay attention, he added. Coming just 24 hours after millions of Americans showed up at polling places across the U.S. to cast their ballots in the presidential race and down-ballot contest on Wednesday, November 4th, marked the first time the U.S. recorded at least 100,000 new coronavirus infections just in a single day. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been warning since June, when the U.S. was reporting around 40,000 cases daily, that the U.S. could reach 100,000 new infections per day if more aggressive preventive measures were not taken by the federal government in partnership with the state and local leaders. "We are in for a whole lot of hurt. It's not a good situation," Fauci told the Washington Post recently. "All the stars are aligned in the wrong place as you go into the fall and winter season, with people congregating at home indoors. You could not possibly be positioned more poorly," he added. On top of the surge in COVID cases across the U.S., coronavirus hospitalizations are also soaring in more than a dozen states, according to data compiled by the COVID Tracking Project. The latest record-shattering coronavirus figures came days after Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, warned in an internal report dated November 2nd that the U.S. is entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic, and urged the Trump administration to take much more aggressive action. Cases are rapidly rising in nearly 30% of all USA counties, the highest number of county hotspots we have seen with this pandemic, reads Burke's report, which was obtained by the Post. Half of the United States is in the red or orange zone for cases despite flat or declining testing, she added. As Burke sounded the alarm behind the scenes and other experts issued similar warnings publicly, Trump continued to hold crowded in-person rallies in the days leading up to Tuesday, November 3rd election and downplayed the severity of the pandemic, which has killed more than 234,000 people in the United States alone. As Common Dreams reported over the weekend, the Stanford University analysis linked 18 of Trump's campaign rallies from June 20 to September 30 to more than 30,000 coronavirus infections and at least 700 deaths. That's all I hear about now. Turn on television. COVID, 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 COVID. A plane goes down, 500 people dead. They don't talk about it. COVID, 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 COVID. Trump told a crowd of his supporters in North Carolina late last month. By the way, on November 4th, you won't hear about it anymore. Dr. Peter Hoetz, a professor at Baylor College of Medicine, tweeted recently that he has long worried the United States would reach 100,000 COVID cases in a single day. A grim milestone, he said, further lays bare the Trump administration's failure. I dreaded this day, here it is, and the lights are off for the entire executive branch of the federal government in the U.S., Hoetz said. Historic and unprecedented abandonment of the American people. I'm horrified, he added.
Hi everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will explore how people and government of India see and react to the normalization of relations with Israel.
The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have formally established diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime in deals brokered and promulgated by the US President Donald Trump. Palestinians have decried the move as a grave betrayal to the people and cause of Palestine, saying that formalizing ties with the Zionist regime further undermines efforts to achieve self-determination. However, the American president says that there are several other Arab states that are willing to go public with their Israeli affairs.
Some Arab countries are formally normalizing their relations with Israel. Most Muslims around the world are against it, and there are regular protests against the move in numerous countries, whether the respective governments support it or not. Evidently, the Indian government supports it, which is quite against the common spirit of the majority of the people in the subcontinent, and not only the Muslims.
It's despicable, sad, condemnable, unfortunate. And whatever we can say about this relation between Arab and Israel, It's beyond words.
As far as Indian Muslims are concerned, they have already expressed their strong condemnation about the recent normalization of the ties between Israel and UAE.
If you talk about Indian perspective, not just the Indian Muslims, but the Indian people at large have been and will always be with the Palestinian cause and have always condemned Israel and its aggression.
U.S. President Donald Trump was the force behind the agreement for the UAE and Bahrain to establish normal diplomatic relations with Israel. The day after Trump announced the deal, UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan briefed Indian External Affairs Minister Subrahmanyam Jaishankar about the move in a telephone call that the minister really appreciated. The timing of the proclamation seems suspiciously beneficial for Trump's re-election, as both Israel and UAE want him back in the White House. Trump wants to sell the agreement as a diplomatic victory in his campaign and tries to brand it Abraham Accord, as Abraham was father of all three great faiths.
The agreement is a part of a broader re-election show by Trump and his administration, who earlier this year revealed the so-called Middle East peace plan, which was categorically rejected by the Palestinians as well as other countries of the region. Even if Trump loses the elections, UAE is not likely to face any major diplomatic repercussions, as the Democratic hopeful Joe Biden has also welcomed the deal, cluelessly calling it a historic step to bridge the deep divides of the Middle East.
Some Arab states of the Persian Gulf had already established covert ties with Israel, so why is now the time to risk and go public about them? The UAE and Bahrain are the third and fourth Arab state after Egypt and Jordan to have opened diplomatic lines. If Abu Dhabi and Manama do not face any serious consequences, the move may serve as a catalyst for other states to follow suit. Trump has even more re-election stunts on his list and is pushing more countries such as Sudan and Oman toward Israel. India's reaction to the agreement is not surprising, as all the three nations behind the move have become close partners of India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi government. Israel and India have enjoyed close relations in recent years, and Modi has also been able to cultivate strong relations with the UAE. India sees this as a potentially positive sign, as the normalization may create a more favorable political environment for its interests in the Middle East.
Now, to add more insight, we are joined by Mr. Vijay Prasad, who is a historian, journalist, and director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He is also the author of the book Namaste Sharon, Hindutva and Sharonism under U.S. Hegemony. Mr. Prasad, welcome to the subcontinent. So, in the past few decades, there have been many reports exposing Arab-Israeli back-channel links. Why have they decided to formalize their relations now?
You see, now, and when you talk about Arab, you mean mainly the United Arab Emirates. And we need to understand that there is an increased tension between the UAE and Turkey over a range of issues. On the one side, their battle over Libya. On the other side, their battle over gas fields in the Eastern Mediterranean. Turkey and the UAE have been struggling with each other over certain resources and regions in the greater North African, West Asian region. I have a feeling that the UAE, seeking to get European and American backing for its project, essentially normalized with Israel as a way to curry favor and therefore to put pressure on Turkey. There's no way the UAE can confront Turkey directly. So this is a way to get diplomatic favor in Washington, D.C., perhaps in Paris and so on, and allow that pressure to be put on Turkey so that Turkey backs off in, you know, on the one side in Libya and on the other side in the very important energy battles taking place in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, you're focusing on UAE, but Bahrain has also normalized relations with Israel recently, and Oman is in the pipeline. And you're saying that India is supporting this move because it wants to put pressure on Turkey and gain favors from the U.S. So, does the Indian government support the normalization of relations between Israel and Arab states?
It's hard to say whether the Indian government directly supports the normalization, because India, as you know, plays a double game here. On the one hand, India has normalized with Israel and started that process in 91-92. On the other hand, India is a little careful, even under the Narendra Modi government, of too direct statements regarding the issue of Palestine or Israel, so as not to jeopardize relations mainly with Saudi Arabia, because there's a feeling that Saudi Arabia, a big energy provider to India, might not like it if India is too much public about its support for Israel. So India generally keeps a sort of double game here and hasn't come out directly and said we support the UAE or we don't support the UAE. I mean, in that sense, silence on this is to India's benefit.
Now, Mr. Prasad, our team has collected global media coverages in this regard, and we would like you to take a look on that, and then we can continue with the question answer session.
Historic as this moment is, it's worth looking at the larger geopolitical forces at work here and the short-term and long-term calculations of the key players involved. In the Machiavellian world of the Middle East, nothing is as clear-cut as it first appears. That's why it's also important that India play its cards carefully as it comes to terms with a changing Middle East. The fog over the emerging realignments in the region has officially lifted. India's strategic partnership with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE is a major pillar of India's relationship with the West Asian region. This partnership will be strengthened. With India's growing ties to the US, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, and ties with Iran and Turkey floundering over the Kashmir issue, the agreement will buttress Delhi's ties with the region.
Thank you for staying with us, Mr. Prasad, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Prasad, you earlier said that India is playing a double game. How can the Indian government support the Palestinian cause and Israel at the same time? Isn't it hypocritical? How is it possible?
To support the Palestinian cause and to support Israel at the same time is simply not possible, because in a sense, the Israeli project is about the annihilation of the Palestinian project. So you can't support both, I'm afraid. In this case, one has to make a choice. And India has effectively chosen to stand with Israel in terms of the Israel colonization of the Palestinian people, their life and land and so on. India has made a choice, but it doesn't want to do publicly declare that choice, even though it's made the choice. There'll be some small gestures vis-a-vis the Palestinians. The Indians will go and say, we'll invest in some project in the Palestinian Authority and so on. Small gestures will be made. But by and large, I think India, like many of the Gulf Arab countries, have made their choice and they have decided to stand with Israel against the Palestinian people.
So you're saying that India has made a choice and sided with Israel. So has India abandoned its Gandhian values?
Time ago that Gandhi, Nehru and others made clear their support for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. You know, that was the era of anti-colonialism and struggles, and in a sense what the Palestinians were facing, what they were struggling with, was the struggle of anti-colonialism. You know, they wanted to free themselves from colonialism. This lasts all the way out till the 1980s in India, this support for the anti-colonial struggle. Yasser Arafat, for instance, comes to Delhi in 1983, is met at the airport by Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister. He says that she is my sister. I mean, you know, they were very close relations. The Palestinian Liberation Organization had an office in Delhi. But after India decided to normalize with the United States, actually, first, it was told you have to normalize with Israel. And that is the big shift. When the Soviet Union collapses, it was catastrophic for non-aligned policy. It was catastrophic for third world solidarity. It was catastrophic for the Palestinians. I mean, the PLO went and surrendered, essentially, at Oslo. During the Oslo Accords, those agreements. So, it's not just India that surrendered its support for the Palestinians, but the PLO also in some ways surrendered its own views at Oslo. And that was a sign of the times. And sadly, a new kind of international support for the Palestinian cause has not been properly built up. This is greatly lacking.
Out of more than 190 member states of the United Nations, nearly 140 recognize the state of Palestine, and about 160 also recognize Israel. This means a lot of the governments in the world have relations with both the occupier and the occupied. But when Arab countries connive with the US to establish formal ties with the Zionist regime, many other countries feel emboldened to defend their Israeli ties.
India's official stand about Israel has always been somehow paradoxically, yet conveniently supple. In 2014, India chose to pursue a de-hyphenation policy aiming to deal with both Israel and Palestine in an independent manner. In 2017, India voted against recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and then again in 2018, New Delhi decided to review its Palestine policy when the Palestinian ambassador to Pakistan was photographed, along with the chief of Lashkar-e-Taiba, a militant group blamed for the 2008 Mumbai siege. While Palestine calls this a betrayal that blows up every possibility for peace, India welcomes the full normalization of ties between UAE and Israel, calling both key strategic partners. New Delhi says it still continues its traditional support for the Palestinian cause. But how? It seems that the Middle East has more than enough sand for everybody to bury their heads in. Otherwise, the world would notice such inconsistent and constantly changing policies. Israel, UAE, and the US claim the normalization is an exchange of Tel Aviv suspending its annexation of Palestinian territories. But from the Palestinian point of view, the UAE and Bahrain have destroyed any hopes of establishing an independent state with this move that can never slow Israeli expansionism.
This step is very dangerous step because it will encourage some other countries in order to normalize their relation with Israel, which is not normal, which is against our religion, which is against our history.
Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. This Mahatma Gandhi's 1938 remark about Palestine is the most quoted utterance in any literature of India's foreign policy. The first blow to Gandhian values was in 1992, when India reversed its four-decade-old policy of recognition without relations and normalized relations with the Israeli regime. Now, with India's support for the normalization of ties with Israel, Gandhi's statement that Palestine belongs to the Arabs is further losing its relevance.
Several pundits believe it is not surprising, not even a big deal, that a number of Arab countries are going public with their previously covert ties with Israel, as some others, including India, stand and applaud. Formalized relations with Israel probably guarantee garnering bipartisan favor with the United States. And the US approval means a green light for authoritarian governments to suppress all different voices and domestic challenges with less chance of international pressure. Thanks to formalizing relations with Israel, Bahrain's Al Khalifa family have acquired an influential ally in its fight against domestic opposition. This can also be true for Saudi Arabia, which is still gauging the prospects of normalization, since Riyadh seeks to nip the bud for political liberalization that would challenge the legitimacy of the ruling Al-Saud monarchy, including demands for change from its own repressed Shia minority. The Indian government longs for such an opportunity. India has compelling reasons to feel optimistically comfortable, but its open support for Israeli relations may put its own interests and dealings at stake in the Middle East. If New Delhi puts all its eggs in the Arab basket, Islamabad may align itself more closely with Tehran and Ankara, all in the backdrop of growing Iran-China and Pakistan-Iran ties.
For more analysis, we are now joined by Dr. Tasleem Ahmed Rahmani, who is the President of Muslim Political Council of India and the National Secretary of Social Democratic Party of India. Dr. Rahmani, welcome to the show. So, how do the Indian people, especially the 200 million Muslims, view these Arab countries formalizing ties with Israel.
You see, the Indian Muslims are traditionally and historically against the Israel and with standing always with the Palestinian cause. Still, the general public, and there is no change in their stand, in their policy towards Palestine and towards Israel. We have always taken Israel as a traitor country, as an occupier, and as a terrorist state. And we still, at our public level, general public level, we still go that stand, and we very vociferously, we are here to boycott the Israeli product, and our Union government still towards the pro-Israeli policy is being strongly condemned by the Indian Muslims because we take it as an occupier.
Okay, so you're saying that people side with the Palestinian cause and condemn the support of the Indian government for Israel. India has strong economic ties with Arab countries. Do you see this as a weight on the Indian government to support Arab normalization with Israel?
Yes, indeed. You see the change in India. It's a fascist regime. We always termed it as a fascist regime, as a saffronized and a right-wing, a radicalized political party is the BJP. And after the BJP has taken over, they have just opened up their relationship with Israel. Most of our security installations, our business ties, economic ties, agriculture sector, power sector, telecommunication sector, the government of India has a big tie-up with the Israeli government. And ideologically, this BJP, RSS, and Israel policy has an affinity in they stand at the same pedestal. That's why the strong bonding between India and Israel has repercussions on the Indo-Arab relationship. So as far as the Arab countries are coming closer to Israel, the India is also becoming closer to those Muslim countries or Arab countries which are coming closer to Israel. That's why they praise UAE, they praise Saudi Arabia, some of such Gulf countries. While this is a fact that our relationship, as far as our foreign policy is concerned, our relation with Saudi Arabia was not very cordial. It was just a normal relationship we always maintained with Saudi Arabia and other such Gulf countries. But after this change in regime and the shift in foreign policy, this relationship has become more cordial just because of the relationship with Israel are coming more, the diplomatic relation is coming more closer with those Gulf rulers. That's obviously the government of India has taken a step towards them, and they have made their bonding much more stronger just because of Israel.
Now, Dr. Rahmani, let's just quickly take a look at how global media has covered this issue, and then we can continue with the question.
In late November 2019, there was widespread outrage over a video of the Indian Consul General in New York, Sandeep Chakravorty, in which he suggested to a gathering of Kashmiri Hindus that India should follow the Israeli model and build settlements in the Kashmir Valley to secure the return of Hindus. Kashmiri activists and journalists were shocked by his apparent support for Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. But this is only one of many recent examples of a growing political love affair between India and Israel. Retired Indian Foreign Service officer Navdeep Suri, who had been India's ambassador to UAE until late 2019, has told The Wire that the trends towards the normalization of ties between Israel and UAE had been clearly discernible in the last couple of years as the two were driven by their joint antipathy towards Iran.
All right, Dr. Rahmani, welcome back to the show. So you're saying that the Indian government loves Israel and is therefore supporting the Arab countries who are formalizing their relations with the Israeli regime. India has a history of supporting Palestinian cause. Has anything changed there in India with this regard?
You see, Gandhian values, Gandhi, Congress and Muslims and so many other groups like the liberals, communists, social organizations, they were always pro-Palestine, pro-Ghanaian. This regime, and particularly this ideology, which RSS pose, they claim today that they are actually the Ghanaian. While they do not belong to Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy, they are actually the killers of Gandhi, and not only the killer of Gandhi, they are the killer of Ghanaian ideology. But because Gandhi is the tallest icon in our nation, and no regime can go further without taking the name of Gandhi. That's why the present establishment try to show that they are also Ghanaian, and that's why. Otherwise, they have nothing to do with Gandhi or Gandhi philosophy, actually. So there is a shift in the Israel and Palestine policy, but that doesn't mean that the Gandhi or Gandhi ideology has tilted towards that policy. This is a fraud and this is a farce that this RSS and BJP try to pose that they are also Ghanaian. No, they are not Ghanaians. They take advantage of, but you must understand that the general public, the normal population of India, they are pro-Palestinian till today. There is not a single day goes by when we don't find a report, a positive report about Palestine in our print media, particularly the Urdu media. There is not a single day pass when we don't have a report about the Gaza people, about the Hamas people, about the plights of Palestine. So the general population, and not only Muslim, rather the social groups, the secularist groups, they are still standing with the Palestine in the same way we used to stand before 2014. But this regime was against Palestine even before coming to the power. They are still against Palestine. They will remain against Palestine always because they are right-winger radicalized people.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the issue of normalization of ties with the Zionist regime and India's stance towards it. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillah. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves.
Abi Talib told the Holy Prophet to pursue his goal. I swear by God that I will not give you away, no matter what I receive in return. There were not more than 30 or 40 of them. These 30 or 40 people tolerated all those hardships and increased in number on a daily basis. Each day they were witness to what they did to Ammar and Bilal. They were witness to the torturing and martyrdom of Sumayya and Yasir. They were witness to these things, but they still converted to Islam. That is the way righteousness is promoted. The mere raising of the flag in peace and security will not help promote righteousness. Righteousness will be promoted only when there is steadfastness and perseverance on the part of righteous people who believe in righteousness.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever wanna need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
There is a verse in the Quran, Surah 48, verse 29, that says, Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and those with him are firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves. The phrase, firm against the disbelievers, does not mean that Muslims are involved in a constant war with the disbelievers. Rather, it means strength and solidity. Firm means solid here. This solidity may be manifested in a particular manner on the battlefield. It may also be manifested in another way when negotiating with the enemy. Just see how the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family talked to his enemies when it was necessary to do so. His plans were the embodiment of solidity without any flaws.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the President-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said for them nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agreed that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump, the man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden. But at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Munakandi, Occupy Ramallah.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash-strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
On Friday, taxi drivers went on a one-day strike nationwide, calling the government's attention to the economic plight they're facing following the pandemic crisis and the connected restrictions. Unions also called two protests held in front of the economy and transport ministries, attended by thousands of taxi drivers from across the country. Drivers are demanding more support from the government as, quote, they don't have the money to pay the monthly costs of the vehicles, nor to provide for their families.
Gli aiuti ricevuti sono assolutamente insufficienti.
The subsidies we have received from the government so far are totally inadequate. 275 euros each month is not sufficient. How are we supposed to put food on the table for our families? Consider we have suffered losses in the range of 80 to 90%.
Intorno ai 3600 euro.
Io ho ricevuto.
My income has dropped by 80%, but all expenses have remained unvaried. Insurance fees, fuel and car disinfection costs have not been reduced. Furthermore, the government is doing nothing to stop illegal cabs from going around.
È molto alta.
A new three-tier restriction system came into force on Friday. As a result, four Italian regions, namely Calabria, Lombardy, Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, have been placed in soft lockdowns. The government has also imposed a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. until 5 a.m., requiring all museums and galleries to shut down and all shopping centers to close on weekends.
Protests against the new anti-COVID restrictions imposed by the government have been staged in a number of cities across Italy. Some demonstrations turned violent as protesters vented their frustration and anger over how the pandemic crisis has been handled.
The virus is a moving train. Today it is necessary to slow it down, otherwise the train will knock us down. We are hopeful that these measures will be limited to several weeks.
The new restrictions imposed by the Italian government apply for about 4 weeks until December 3. Max Civili, Rome.
On the 14th of March 2011, Bahraini security forces began a violent crackdown on protests demanding greater political participation, free and fair elections, and an end to corruption and equality for the country's suppressed Shia majority. It has now been revealed that the UK's top military officer, General Sir David Richards, was in Manama holding meetings with the country's senior military officials and the Crown Prince 5 days earlier. In the brutal crackdown, Bahrain security forces were backed by 1,000 UK-trained and equipped Saudi troops. Since then, almost all prominent human rights defenders and dissidents have been jailed, silenced, or forced into permanent exile. The main opposition party, Al-Wefaq, has been dissolved, and the country's only independent newspaper, Al-Wasat, forcibly closed down. Torture is widespread in Bahrain's prisons, especially for the purpose of extracting confessions that are used to sentence people to death. And the country has the largest number of political prisoners in relation to population.
We have interviewed people, men, women and children, who have been tortured by the regime. Children who have been snatched from the streets by armed gangs and have been then beaten and driven around the streets. One boy had his teeth knocked in, and they are forced then to inform on family members or friends or people that they know in the villages who have attended democratic protests or have attended political gatherings. Inside the prisons, people have been waterboarded. They've been beaten with truncheons on their bare bodies and on their feet. They've been hung for hours, days, and deprived of sleep. They have been anally raped with truncheons. They have been just the cruelest, most inhumane treatment.
Nonetheless, the British government continues to support the regime. When construction began on a new permanent naval base in Bahrain in 2015, then UK Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said this.
This will give us the flexibility to respond to any emerging challenge in the Gulf, whether it's from a state actor or a non-state actor, whether it's from within the Gulf or outside the Gulf. This enhances our range. It gives Britain a permanent naval base east of Suez for the first time since 1967.
Strategic interests seem to be Westminster's priority. According to Human Rights Watch, arbitrary arrests, torture, executions and forced disappearances continue with very little interference from so-called democracies. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Your dear,
With the name of martyr Qasim Soleimani decorating the Persian language department at the University of Sana'a, the first graduates of the department walking down it, reviving the memory of Hajj Qasim, who they carried his name as a title for their badge.
When we talked about the Persian language, it was impossible to learn it because of the international fight against it, and whoever spoke it was considered as the enemy of Islam. Today, however, we have proof to the world that we and the Iranian people are brothers, and Islam unites us.
Graduates expressed their overwhelming joy of this accomplishment, stressing that their choice name for the Soleimani badge comes at a critical time in light of American unilateralism reaching its peak.
Sadafi had martyr Soleimani is a first in the region, and his support for the Palestinian cause requires us to revive his memory by naming a badge in his name.
The ceremony came after Hassan Erlu presented his credentials to the President of the Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, as Ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen. This shows the depth of the Yemeni-Iranian relations, especially with the U.S. escalating its hostile policies towards the two countries and towards the resistance axis as a whole. Erlu's predecessor left Sana'a in September 2015, and in October last year, Iran's foreign ministry said the process of sending a new ambassador was hindered by attacks on the embassy.
While some Persian Gulf Arab states leaders rushed to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, Yemenis continued to reaffirm their support for the Palestinian cause. Abdul Latif Al-Wash, Ali, Sana'a.
Vienna pays tribute to the victims of Monday's terror attack carried out by a sympathizer of the Daesh terrorist group.
It's a really tense situation, something we never had before in Vienna. So Vienna was always a really secure place, and we felt really safe and protected, and suddenly, well, out of nowhere, this comes. I'm living nearby, and hearing this was really shocking.
As the nation tries to come to grips with the terrifying shooting, news has emerged of serious mishaps in the run-up to the crime. Austria's interior minister confirmed the country did have intelligence that the gunman had traveled to Slovakia in search of ammunition in July. Apparently, a crucial tip was not followed up. Karl Nehammer admitted to official errors.
Something obviously went wrong in our communications. An independent commission of inquiry has been set up.
In Parliament, his predecessor from the right-wing FPÖ party called for the minister's resignation. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has called for more decisive action at the EU level against what he termed political Islam. Earlier, he'd made it clear the attack should not be seen as a conflict between Christians and Muslims. Experts believe if the correct attributions are not made, it could trigger cultural wars in society.
If you define terrorism, it's the use of force against civilians in order to create fear for political purposes. So that's terrorism. That doesn't have, this definition doesn't have much to do with religion. So it's not necessary to call it Islamic or Islamist terror.
The 20-year-old gunman, an Austrian with North Macedonian roots, had been released from prison in December. Apparently, he misled the government's so-called de-radicalization program. The main worry now is how Europe is going to deal with what experts describe as the growing threat of homegrown terrorism. Homolinski, Vienna.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked the International Day to End Impunity for Crimes Against Journalists in front of the United Nations office. Journalists demanded an end to Israel's impunity and that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists. The Palestinian Journalist Syndicate handed a memorandum to UN officials demanding protection for Palestinian journalists. Since the beginning of 2019, Israeli forces carried out hundreds of attacks against Palestinian journalists.
وهي جرائم ممنهجة وبشكل يومي.
Attacks against journalists are systematic and take place almost every day. Israeli forces target Palestinian journalists in almost every protest or event. Since last year alone, Palestinian journalists were attacked over 750 times.
According to human rights organizations, Israeli forces killed 43 journalists over the last 20 years. Additionally, hundreds of journalists were seriously injured, sustaining permanent disabilities that will probably accompany them throughout their lives.
The United Nations must come out of its silence and protect Palestinian journalists who are constantly subjected to Israeli crimes. Israeli forces have killed dozens of Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds more, while others are still in Israeli custody. We call on the United Nations to help bring Israeli criminals to justice at the International Criminal Court.
During the Great March of Return rallies, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian journalists and injured hundreds while they were covering the peaceful action. Palestinian journalists say they work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
We are coming under deliberate and premeditated attacks by Israeli soldiers during the peaceful rallies. Israeli forces killed two of my colleagues and injured hundreds, and I was injured twice while covering the protests. Some of the journalists sustained permanent disabilities.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
Israeli attacks against journalists have increased in recent years. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of Israel. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." They had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted, you do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold. Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
sans doute